This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. What do frizzy hair, food, and pharmaceuticals have in common? Of course, they all depend on chemistry. And to be very honest with you, chemistry is not my long suit. It was one of my nightmares in school, but you don't have to study the periodic table, thank goodness, to appreciate some of the research being talked about at this week's American Chemical Society meeting in Philadelphia. So we've rooted out some of the more interesting ideas, and here to talk about them is Aaron Rao. He is writes for Wired Science. He joins us today from San Francisco. Thank you, Aaron Rao, for joining us.
Howdy, Ira.
Hi there. Tell us, what does chemistry have to do with frizzy hair?
Well, so the science of conditioners is a really tricky one. Nobody knows exactly how they work. And so what Eva Max, who's a graduate student at the University of Bayreuth in Germany, has done is use this contraption called an atomic force microscope to look at individual hairs down to the nanometer level and figure out what's going on with these hairs, if they're wet, if they're dry, if they're conditioned, if they've got split ends, if they're frizzy. And so she's taken a closer look than anyone else ever has at all these different types of hair in different states and sort of understood the science better than anyone else has of how to make them pretty.
This is a billion-dollar industry, is it not?
It certainly is. And I think that what she's really doing is the basic science that will lead to better conditioners, better shampoos, and other hair care products.
And better microscopic pictures of those hair follicles on television.
There we go. The thing that she's really done here is understand whether friction plays a role, whether the hairs are just bulked up by these conditioners, which kind of make a coating on the hair, or whether they can slide past one another more gracefully when they're coated in this sort of almost lubricant-like substance.
Very interesting. 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about chemistry with Adam Rao. And so they take this very seriously, don't they?
They certainly do, but not too seriously. During the press conference related to this talk, someone asked, why are you doing this research? And Eva said, because I'm a girl.
Oh, gee.
So,
Aaron, there must be men working on this stuff, too.
Yeah, her advisor, Andres Ferry, is a man, but he seems like the supportive advisor type. From what I understand, all of this project is hers and hers alone, and it's her thesis research. So she's doing this to get a PhD. Imagine that, getting a PhD in hair care.
I think that's a lucrative job coming up.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, there's all this money involved in studying these things for hair care products. Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about something interesting about the tobacco mosaic virus.
Oh, this is fantastic. So in theory, you could stop a lot of diseases, everything from viruses to cancer, by shutting down a gene that causes that disease. And so the way to do that is to take these tiny little RNA molecules called small interfering RNAs and to put them into the cell. And that causes the cell to destroy whatever gene is causing this disease. And so it's been done with respiratory syncytial virus and cancers in theory. But in practice, you need a way to protect this very ephemeral molecule, this very delicate molecule, this small interfering RNA. And so the tobacco mosaic virus is essentially a biodegradable nanometer-sized tube that you can pack this stuff into. And so Bill Bentley at the University of Maryland has been working with his graduate students to pack small interfering RNA into these tobacco mosaic virus tubes and then to see whether that can help them get into cells and survive the harsh environment of the body so that they can make it to these diseased parts of the body and have their effect.
And do they get there?
Well, what they've done so far is in vitro tests. So they're planning to move on to animals soon, but what they've done is packaged this RNA in these tubes, and then they've put it into cells like cancer cells or kidney cells, and they've shown that they can switch off a gene of their choice sort of at will. And so the other nice thing about this is the other means of delivering these RNA molecules to cells are relatively harsh. So there's a possibility that you could use a virus that can infect humans, and then there's the risk of causing some sort of an immune system failure or other sort of collateral damage. And with a tobacco virus, it can't infect humans, and in fact, it needs a little bit of extra nudging to get into the cells. And so it's a much safer way to do this, a much safer way to have this medical effect.
So that's what would be its competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so it's worked in cells. They want to test it on animals, and then they want to test it in people. And at the same time, there are other companies, like there's one called Alnylam, which is in New England, and they're testing inhaled RNA. So you can actually take an inhaler and shoot a bunch of RNA up your nose into your lungs. And what this would do is it would stop respiratory syncytial virus from taking over the cells in the lining of your lungs. And so it essentially instructs those cells to stop producing the virus. Because viruses are like hijackers. They go into a cell, they take it over, they make that cell produce their genes. And so what this small interfering RNA does is it says, stop, don't do that, shred that virus on site. And so they've actually tested that in humans, and it's worked quite well in healthy males. And hopefully they'll be able to use it on infants and old people who are most likely to get that virus.
Sounds like a general all-purpose virus.
I mean,
it sounds like a great little carrier for stuff.
Mm-hmm. So I think we're in the midst of a revolution in how we treat disease with these small interfering RNAs.
Well, we got to make sure they work, though, first.
Yeah, they work for respiratory syncytial virus very effectively.
Yeah. And any other ways they might work? Any other delivery methods?
So there's a chance of delivering them to the liver for liver cancer. And mm-hmm. So you'd knock down one of the genes so cancer is the out-of-control division of cells, and you would switch off one of the genes that causes cells to grow very rapidly, and hopefully that would sort of calm them down. And so you could, in theory, switch off one of these signal-sending, disease-causing proteins using small interfering RNA, but that work mm-hmm. probably could make use of this tobacco mosaic virus. You need something to get the RNA to the tumor and into the cancer cells, and that's a potential application of this tobacco mosaic virus.
Hmm. So something that we would normally think of attacking a tobacco plant, we can use to make us possibly more healthy.
Yes, to attack our tumors.
Interesting. One of the research items that caught my eye was one about a micro spacecraft. Is that just really a tiny, small spaceship?
Yeah, so small spacecraft are the best thing to happen to NASA in years because they can spend $3 million on a mission instead of 60. So these small, they're small, they don't take very many people to build them or test them or design them, and it means they're risking less. A lot of these missions fail because satellite crashes or the launch fails, and so this allows them to get a lot more done for a lot less money with a lot less risk. And what this story is actually more of a material science story, or a space age materials science story. So these gentlemen have come up with a electrochromic material, and it's like a chameleon skin. It changes its color sort of the way you want it, and it can only switch between light and dark. And so when it's dark, it will absorb lots of light, and it will warm up the spacecraft. So if this is sort of like a jacket on the outside of the spacecraft, and it's on the dark side of a planet, it can sort of warm itself up by darkening and absorbing every last little bit of light that it can find. When it's on the light side of a planet, not in the shadow, when it's in bright sunlight, it can lighten and sort of reflect away most of that light so it won't heat up. And it can also do this in the infrared range. And so the idea is that they have a very compact, very elegant, very simple way of replacing the cooling systems of spacecraft so they can be smaller and lighter and more nimble.
Just by changing the color on them?
Yes, but while changing the darkness.
Yeah, whether they absorb sunlight or not.
Yes.
Wow, and that's because they're so small. How small are we talking about here?
We're talking about the size of a birthday cake. And we're talking about something that weighs less than a person weighs. So very, very small satellite in comparison to these Hubble telescope-type satellites, yeah, which are the size of a VW Bug or larger.
So 50 pounds, something like that?
Yeah, something on the order of 50 pounds.
Are these in production yet?
Yes. In fact, one of them blew up on its way to orbit on the third launch of the Falcon 1 rocket on the first weekend of this month. So there's a company called SpaceX, and they're trying to launch things into space for much less money than a normal launch.
Private company.
But this is a private company, yeah, funded by the Elon Musk, the founder of PayPal.
Right.
And they had two NASA cheap spacecraft on board. One's called, it's called PreSat, or PreSat, and the other one is called the NanoSail. And one was made by NASA Ames, and one was made by Marshall. And both of them met their end during this failed launch, but NASA really cut their losses by using these small satellites instead of really chunky ones.
Hmm. And so you can replace that one.
Well, you can. They're out $3 million rather than, say, $60 million, which would be a more traditional cost for a satellite.
Yeah. 1-800-989-8255. Talking with Aaron Rowe of Wired Science magazine. Wasn't one of the sessions about food there?
Oh, yes. So every year at the summer American Chemical Society meeting, they give an award to a journalist. And this year they gave it to a guy named Harold McGee. And he's been spending 20 years studying the science of deliciousness. And we had a fantastic conversation in the press room talking about flavor tripping parties. This is when you take a substance called miraculin and you put it on your tongue and it fools your taste buds into thinking that sour things are sweet.
Uh-huh.
And so he says that he thinks that it gets boring after a while, and so they should figure out how to make it only last for one course of the meal so it doesn't ruin the experience of the rest of what could be a very complicated, elegant meal.
Hmm.
And he also seems to think that molecular gastronomy, which Wired has certainly plugged quite a bit, and you see it all over popular science magazines, is a bit of a hoax, because cooks aren't thinking of food in terms of molecules. They're not thinking of food in terms of chemicals. They think in terms of ingredients.
Hmm.
And so it's sort of, I guess you could say, a clever way to sell lab equipment to rich reviews.
Hang on, Aaron. We're going to have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about what's happened at the American Chemical Society meeting with Aaron Rowe, who writes for Wired Science, among other publications. Take some of your questions. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the latest chemistry research with my guest Aaron Rowe, a journalist for Wired Science. This week he attended the national meeting of the American Chemical Society. And joining the discussion now is Dr. Umut Özkan. Dr. Özkan is a professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering at Ohio State University. And the ACS, she presented research on a cheaper method of making hydrogen from biofuels, and she's here to talk to us about that today. She's joining us from Columbus. Welcome to the program, Dr. Özkan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Tell us about this. If I understand this correctly, you have found a much cheaper way, a cheaper catalyst for making hydrogen out of biofuels. Is that right?
That's correct. Our research is in the area of heterogeneous catalysis. Maybe I can say a word or two about what a catalyst is. A catalyst is a material which makes a chemical reaction go faster, but it doesn't get consumed in the process. It can make the reaction rate faster. It mm-hmm. can change the selectivity of a reaction, so allows us to make more of the desired product as opposed to the undesired product. But it doesn't get consumed in the reaction. The focus of our research has been using bioethanol as the hydrogen source and developing catalysts which are not based on precious metals, but on much cheaper transition metals to make hydrogen from bioethanol. And our research has progressed quite nicely, and at this point we do have a catalyst that's looking very promising.
What catalyst would that be?
It is a cobalt-based catalyst. It is supported on Ethereum, but there are other promoters and dopants in the mix, including calcium and copper. And also the way we prepare the catalyst is very crucial because you can have the same composition, but unless you tailor the catalyst surface in a certain way, you don't get the same catalytic performance.
So if you mix this catalyst in with, let's say, the alcohol, bubbles hydrogen?
Alcohol and water is the reaction. So it's a steam reforming of alcohol. Actually, it takes place in the gas phase. So we are heating the ethanol water mixture so that everything is in the vapor phase. And we are getting hydrogen yields over 90%.
90%?
Right.
Now, if you have the fuel in the form of ethanol already, why would you want to make it into hydrogen?
That's a very good question. I think ethanol, as you know, can be used as a fuel. We can burn it, or we can convert it to hydrogen and use it in a fuel cell. Now, fuel cells have much higher efficiencies compared to internal combustion engines. The maximum efficiency you can get from an internal combustion engine is less than 20%. Whereas with a hydrogen fuel cell, you can get much higher efficiencies, around 50% or even higher. So clearly, you can get more bang for your bucks, so to speak. You can get more energy for the input ethanol that you're using.
So this also would seem to me solve a problem people have with transporting hydrogen around the country of you know, it's burnable. Could you make the hydrogen right there at the filling station? You get a shipment through the pipeline of ethanol, you throw the stuff into the converter, and out comes hydrogen.
Actually, that's how we're envisioning the process to go. The process really lends itself quite well to a distributed hydrogen generation, hydrogen production strategy. So we can have catalytic reactors at the gas stations where the hydrogen produced on site, and the only thing that will need to be delivered is the liquid ethanol, and we already have the infrastructure in place for transporting liquid fuels.
So you're ready there for when fuel cell powered cars are rolling in, and you've got the hydrogen ready for them.
Well, we certainly have made very good progress. I can't say we are ready to go commercial. There are still several fundamental questions that we're trying to address, but we certainly have made very good progress in that direction.
How do you talk to the people who say, you know, we don't like the idea that we're making all this ethanol because it's driving up the price of food and making food scarce?
Again, that's a very good question. When people think of bioethanol, they think that the only source of ethanol is corn or soybean, things that we use either for food or for animal feed. But that really doesn't have to be the case. We can get ethanol from other sources. For example, cellulosic ethanol can be obtained from cellulose. We can use switchgrass, corn stalks, wood chips, used frying oil. Even algae can be used for making ethanol. So we don't really have to rely on food or feed crops. That will certainly have an impact on the prices of those.
What kind of cooperation and partnerships do you need to make with other people so that this might work?
This is a project which is funded by U.S. Department of Energy. We are always talking about our research in the regular meetings of the Department of Energy with other national laboratories, including some industrial potential partners. So I think after we answer some more of the fundamental questions, probably we will be ready for scaling up the system for a pilot plant testing.
All right. Hang on. We're going to see if we can get some questions. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Garvey in Binghamton, New York. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hey. Glad you took my call.
So am I so far. Go ahead.
All right. I had a question on whether any of the presentations or the research during this conference was on self-assembling polymers or nanomaterials that might eventually be used to construct larger objects, self-assembling space-age materials that might be used to make, you know, superstructures sometime in the future.
Good question. Aaron Rowe, any?
Well, there are about 8,000 presentations this weekend, and so going to these meetings is kind of like drinking from a fire hose. There's a lot of stuff going on at once. I didn't personally attend or become privy of any of those sessions, but what I can say is that there is an entire polymer science and engineering themed set of sessions, and that it's most likely that that sort of thing did take place. Those sorts of things are commonplace both at American Chemical Society meetings and also at Materials Research Society meetings. Did you have any more questions about that?
I think that was it. Let's go to JC in Baton Rouge. Hi, JC.
Good evening, sirs.
Good afternoon to you.
Afternoon, whatever it may be.
It is Friday. We allow for that.
Okay. This is so exciting. The whole thing, the question I have for the lady, I'd like to get off and hear it on the air, is I'm sure somebody has considered, but right away it popped in my mind, like if I bought one of these hydrogen cells and got the ethyl stuff for my house, couldn't I use it for heat? The homeowner's use of the hydrogen cell, I'd like to hear something about that, please.
Okay. We're going to ask Dr. Oskan.
Fuel cells take hydrogen fuel cells, let's be specific about that. In general, fuel cells can take any fuel and convert it to electricity. In the case of hydrogen, it uses hydrogen and converts it to electricity. So it is really the electricity that we are getting from the fuel cell, whether you use it to run the car or to heat the house. So, yes, it can be used for that. But PEM fuel cells or hydrogen fuel cells are not the only type of fuel cells. There are other fuel cells that are high temperature, which may be more suitable for providing electricity for homes, for example.
And so basically, this is made and aimed toward the use in fuel cells.
The hydrogen, yes, the hydrogen production especially will be more meaningful if we can use them in fuel cells. We can certainly use hydrogen as a fuel, but in a way it will defeat the purpose because we will still be limited by the efficiency of the combustion unit, which is not very efficient.
Well, Dr. Oskan, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And also you, Aaron, good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Aaron.
Aaron Rowe, journalist for Wired Science, and Dr. Umed Oskan, who is a professor of chemical and biomedical biomolecular engineering at Ohio State University.